chapter, verses 7 through 17. Let us listen to the word of the Lord. This is what he showed me. The Lord was standing by a wall that had been built true to the plumb, with the plumb line in his hand. And the Lord asked me, "What do you see, Amos?" "A plumb line," I replied. Then the Lord said, "Look, I am setting a plumb line among my people, Israel, and I will spare them no longer. The high places of Isaac will be destroyed, and the sanctuaries of Israel will be ruined. With my sword, I will rise against the house of Jeroboam. Then Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, sent a message to Jeroboam, king of Israel. Amos is raising a conspiracy against you in the very heart of Israel. The land cannot bear all of his word, for this is what Amos is saying. Jeroboam will die by the sword, and Israel will surely go in exile, away from the native land. Then Amaziah said to Amos, Get out, you seer. Go back to the land of Judah. Earn your bread there and do your prophesying there. Do not prophesy any more at Bethel, because this is the king's sanctuary and the temple of the kingdom." Amos answered to Amaziah, "I was neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet, but I was a shepherd, and I also took care of the sycamore fig trees. But the Lord took me from tending the flock and said to me, 'Go prophesy to my people Israel. Now then, hear the word of the Lord,' you say. Do not prophesy against Israel, and stop preaching against the descendants of Isaac. Therefore, this is what the Lord says. Your wife will become a prostitute in the city, and your sons and daughters will fall by the sword. Your land will be measured and divided up, and you yourself will die a pagan country. And Israel will surely go into exile, away from the native land. This is the word of the Lord."
Our New Testament reading today is from Luke chapter 10, verses 25 through 37. Let us listen for the word of the Lord. One day, an expert in religious law stood up to test Jesus by asking him this question: "Teacher, what should I do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus replied, "What does the law of Moses say? How do you read it?" The man answered, "You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength, and all your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself." "Right," Jesus told him. "Do this, and you will live." The man wanted to justify his actions, so he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Jesus replied with a story. A Jewish man was traveling from Jerusalem down to Jericho, and he was attacked by bandits. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him up, and left him half dead beside the road. By chance, a priest came along. But when he saw the man lying there, he crossed to the other side of the road and passed him by. A temple assistant walked over and looked at him lying there, but he also passed by on the other side. Then a despised Samaritan came along. And when he saw the man, he felt compassion for him. Going over to him, the Samaritan soothed his wounds with olive oil and wine and bandaged them. Then he put the man on his own donkey and took him to an inn where he took care of him. The next day he handed the innkeeper 2 silver coins, telling him, "Take care of this man. If his bill runs higher than this, I'll pay you the next time I'm here." "Now which of these three would you say was a neighbor to the man who was attacked by bandits?" Jesus asked. The man replied, "The one who showed him mercy." Then Jesus said, "Yes, now you go and do the same." This is the word of the Lord. So, a long time ago in a land far away, I believe it was my first mission trip that I ever went on was to Panama. And it was this little tiny village on the north end of the country up close to Costa Rica. And we had to take a bus all the way from Panama City. It's actually not north. In that case, it's west. Panama runs, you think of Panama as being north-south because the canal gets from one ocean to the other. But it's not. Total geographical tangent there. Nobody cares. We took this bus west up into the hills, and there was this this little town where we were going to build a church, and we were building it out of cinder block on this concrete pad that had been poured before we got there. So we showed up, and there was a cinder block, just a cement pad and a bunch of cinder blocks, and our job was to start building the church. And so, of course, we had a few builders who knew what they were doing, and the rest of us, I was a senior in high school, this was my class trip, and we were not builders. We were doing what they told us, and so some of that involved mixing mortar, and some of that involved hauling blocks, and some of that, they actually got really brave. The builder would snap some lines out on the concrete pad where the walls are supposed to go, and we'd started laying blocks, and then the builder experts would raise the string line, of course, to the next level, and you're supposed to put all the blocks along the line, and once all the blocks on the first course are done on the bottom, then you go up to the second course, and nope, there's supposed to be a door here, and a window starts here on top of the sixth course, and then you need a bond beam here, and so we started to get into a rhythm each day of getting up. We'd eat our breakfast, get on the bus over to the job site, start working. It was pretty hot. I remember we were coming from Nebraska in March, and we were all pretty lily white, and that Panamanian sun was the real thing. And we'd be sweating, and there'd be people whose jobs was taking around water bottles and making sure we were all drinking so we didn't collapse and get dehydrated. And we were working hard, and about the fourth or fifth day, when we were probably about getting up to about head high on the courses, the builder comes around with his level, and he's checking to make sure all of those walls are straight and true and plumb, and he comes to a wall that we'd been working on that was not. Checked it again, pulled out his measuring tape, came back and forth, checked it again, and then just started knocking it over. And I just remember thinking, oh, we've been working on that for days. You're destroying our work. And of course, he said, if I had let that stand before we poured this bond beam, this whole wall would have been crooked and the building could have fallen over and hurt people and it wouldn't have worked. Thanks for reading that text, Alyssa. The text she read from Amos is precisely this vision. It's a vision that Amos has, and this is actually the third vision Amos has. Chapter 7 starts out with the first vision of God showing Amos, and by the way, These are visions that come to Amos, who is, as we saw, a shepherd and a sycamore fig herd. Remember what high rank shepherds occupied in ancient society? Shepherds lived with sheep. Sheep stink. Shepherds stink. Then, as now, people don't love being around people who stink. And so shepherds were very much the bottom tier of ancient society. Amos is not royalty. Amos is not an important person. And yet, this book starts out with saying the word of the Lord came to Amos of Tekoa, a shepherd in the hill country. And chapter 7, there's three visions. Amos has a vision of locusts devouring the land. And he argues with God and says, God, relent. No, don't let this happen. And then he has a vision of fire devouring the land. And he said, God, no, please, we can't handle that. Don't do it. And then he has another vision. And in this vision, it's different. He sees a wall and a plumb line. And instead of arguing with God, this vision moves Amos to go. And we see Amos leaving his flock, which is rare. Shepherds don't like leaving their sheep, because sheep don't do well without a shepherd around. But he does. He takes off and goes, and it is this vision that moves him of a wall that is not true. It is crooked. It's going to collapse. And Amos sees that it is not God knocking this wall over, that the reason the wall is going to collapse is because it is built on a shoddy foundation. It is crooked, and it isn't working. And this is enough for Amos to head out of Tekoa, which, by the way, is in Judah, and head north right past Jerusalem and keep on going all the way to Bethel, to the northern kingdom of Israel, where he delivers this message. Of course, the crooked wall is this kingdom where the poor are being oppressed and taken advantage of, where people are practicing religion and praising God's name, but at the same time practicing injustice, taking advantage of their workers, not taking care of the people around them. Amos sees that such a wall, of course, cannot stand for very long and will collapse. This wall made by a plumb line represents Israel, upheld by uprightness, by justice, fairness, care, and concern for each human being. This justice is such an important, essential aspect of societal stability that in the absence of it, the wall will collapse. The kingdom will fall. And it won't fall because God is knocking it over, but because the kingdom, made crooked by abandonment of justice, will destroy itself. Amos calls Israel to a better future. This is, of course, the role of each of the Hebrew prophets. It is not just calling out injustice and unrighteousness, but saying a better world is possible. That we, as God's people, can structure our lives and our society in a way that takes care of each person. There are three characteristics of all of the Hebrew prophets. One, an engagement with divine love. God, they experience God. They see God's passion and care for each of his kids. Two, they have the courage to stand up and condemn oppression. And it is almost always a combination of the political and religious powers of their day that they stand up and talk to. Amos is not a priest. He is not a pastor. He is a shepherd. He is calling out the priests. He is calling out the king. This is not something easy to do, right? In fact, if you're probably anybody higher up in that society, you might have too much to lose. If you were to speak out against the king, if you were to speak out against the temple, they'd take away what you had. Amos has sheep. No one wants them. He's brave, though. Three, the prophets all have an imagination to envision an alternative future. That these structures that aren't working, this crooked wall, could be built right. That this world that we live in could be structured in a different way than it is. The prophets all deeply believe that the bad things in our world do not have to be that way. That instead we could create a better society, a better religion, a better kingdom. As Rabbi Nahum Lev says, the prophets are the people who are imbued with God's love for creation and consequent passion for justice. The encounter with this love and concern brings forth the prophet, from the prophet, the courage to face what others turn away from, the unsustainability of a society that oppresses the poor. At the same time, the soaring possibilities present in God's loving attention to the world fires the prophet with the imaginative power to present the people with an alternative, life-giving future. Amos, in his message to Israel, over and over says, turn that you might live. Stop doing those things that you might have life and have a kingdom that works for everyone. This is God's passion for his kids flowing through his prophets to change the world. Which only happened 1,500 years ago, right? This was actually more like 2,700 years ago. God, does God still have that passion for his kids? For creating structures, societies where everyone is respected and cared for? I love, of course, the story we read from Luke this morning. One you have heard probably 100 times. The story of the Good Samaritan. What I love about the reading today is, of course, that it put it in its context, right? Jesus doesn't just tell this story out of the blue. Jesus tells this story to a very specific person in a very specific set of circumstances. Who's he talking to? Let me review. One day an expert in religious law stood up to ask Jesus a question. Who's Jesus talking to? A theologian. An expert, someone who's been to divinity school, might even have a PhD. This person knows the Bible. They know theology. They know what they're talking about. And I would like to say, he knows it well, right? If somebody just gives a blank question, in fact, this is an answer that some of the other gospels record Jesus himself as giving, right? When someone says, what must you do to inherit eternal life? Jesus. Or what's the most important commandment? What does Jesus say? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. This guy has great theology. I am impressed with him. He gets it, that this is all about love, right? Good job, man. I'll give him a hand for a minute. Yeah, you nailed it. That this whole thing is about loving God with all that you are, and that means also loving your neighbor as yourself. Dude, win. Except that's apparently not where Jesus leaves it, is it? Because the man asks, who is my neighbor? I'm a Jew. I understand the law correctly. Clearly, those idolaters over there on the other side of the Jordan River aren't my neighbor, right? Surely the Romans oppressing me and enslaving and captivating my kingdom aren't my neighbors. They're my enemies. Surely, the list could go on, right? So Jesus tells this story. And it's a story that wouldn't be too unfamiliar to anyone at the time. Because at the time, the zealots, this word bandits is actually an interesting one. It's kind of a word that it meant just these people outside of society, a little bit like outlaws. They're people who are, we actually know quite a bit about them. We have a lot of our scriptures because they stored them. The Essenes and heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls? These were scrolls preserved by these groups of people who were living in the same place between Jerusalem and Jericho. They were people, zealots, were kind of an overlap with them, who believed in fixing Israel, kicking out the Romans, and restoring God's kingdom the way it should have been through whatever means necessary. And they survived often by robbing the people who were within the system, because, of course, those people were contributing to an unjust system, which didn't deserve to be supported anyhow. And so whoever is traveling from Jerusalem down to Jericho, well, small skin off our teeth if we hurt a few of them in order to restore the kingdom to what it should be, not a big deal. Collateral damage. People get hurt in a war, but we've got to beat the Romans. This guy going, he just says there's a man going from Jerusalem down to Jericho, and he gets attacked and beat up. His money is stolen to support the cause, probably. That's somewhat irrelevant, but that's kind of the shape of things. And he's left for dead, bleeding out. Aren't we glad for church? Because along comes a priest. Wouldn't it be great if religion was about helping people out? Of course, in Jewish purity code, in the Old Testament, the priests were very much forbidden from doing things like coming into contact with blood or dead people, because this made you impure, and then you weren't able to go into the temple. And what work could be more important than your religious duties in the temple? Clearly nothing. That's taking care of God, right? One must make sure that love the Lord your God comes before love your neighbors yourself. I can't let helping some guy that might defile me stop me from doing that which I am doing for my God, which is clearly most important. And so the priest has his priorities straight and makes sure he does not come close enough to get defiled as he walks by the man bleeding out on the side of the road. If that man were to die while he was hauling him back, the priest couldn't go into the temple, he couldn't do his duty to God, and that would be awful. The Levite does the same thing. And then, of course, a Samaritan, one of those people, stops and helps. Jesus is poking pretty hard here. Because for the Jews, there was, of course, very few things as important to them as their national identity. If there was something more important to them than their national identity, it was their religious identity as God's chosen people. The temple, that this was the place God's presence on earth was centered. And Jesus totally throws those two things under the bus for taking care of each other, right? I mean, he makes it even worse. He makes the person doing the good work, the hero of this story, a Samaritan. People with horrible theology. People who don't understand God right, who twist the text, who don't have things figured out. You catch how bizarre this story is? There's an expert in the law who is the best theologian. I agree with him. Everything he says is spot on. And there's a guy who doesn't get it, but is stopping and helping somebody by the side of the road. And Jesus says one of these people is doing it right and the other isn't. This story scares me, honestly, because I like doing theology. I think good theology is important. I might, according to this story, even think good theology is more important than Jesus thinks it is. Right? Because what Jesus is saying in this story is that how much you think love is cool doesn't matter. What matters is, are you taking care of the people you find beat up on the side of the road? That's kind of it. This is an astounding take, right? I mean, Jesus is saying stopping and caring for the beat up people on the side of the road is more important than temple? It's more important than thoroughly understanding the scriptures? Whoa! Jesus is very much speaking in the tradition of the Hebrew prophets. He is envisioning a better future. What life could actually look like where everyone is taken care of. Jesus is calling to account power and institution and religion and saying you should be about something more than good ideas. Good theology doesn't matter if you're not putting it into practice, right? Like the idea of love is wonderful, but if you're not actually loving, which means rolling up your sleeves, getting your hands dirty, spending some of your coin on a place for this guy to stay for the night, then it really doesn't matter. I had the incredible privilege of growing up with my mom as my mom. Some of you might feel the same way, but my mom is one of my heroes, and she definitely taught me how to do this. I believe this always takes some courage, right? One night, in the middle of the night, we lived in Hawaii, and in Hawaii, they build walls out of 2x2s with a little tiny sheet of plywood on the outside and wood paneling on the inside and no insulation in between and open louvered windows. You can hear exactly what your neighbors are talking about. One night, in the middle of the night, we wake up to screaming. Blood-curdling woman screaming. And instantly we are looking out because it sounds like somebody's being murdered. And we look out our windows, and that is just about what it looks like. The neighbor across the street, who was, just to give a good picture to you, a Samoan gentleman who probably weighed 350 pounds, maybe four, was dragging his wife down the street while he hit her by the hair, dragging her by the hair, hitting her. She was screaming. My dad says, "That's awful. Let's call the police." My mom is already out the door. Walks right up to this guy and says, "You can't treat your wife like that. That's not okay. Stop it." And he does. How amazing is that? The rest of us are scared inside the house, terrified. Someone should do something about this. Meanwhile, mom did it. Check. Came back inside. Hey, kids, that's how you take care of that one. That was not, of course, the only time I saw my mom be willing to just step up. Of course, this, as with all of the prophets, as what happens to us in every case, to be willing to be God's agents in the world means standing up with some courage, right? We could get hurt. We could get hit. It could cost us a few of our silver coins along the way. But what better thing could we be doing with our lives? What deeper meaning is there than for us to realize our deep connectedness as family, not just with one another sitting in these pews, but with all of the people out there, wherever we see them, wherever we find them beat up by life's systems, by culture, by society, by economics, by government, whatever it is, wherever we find the people, whatever is causing their suffering, we as God's agents in this world have this powerful, beautiful invitation into saying, I can help with this one. That's what love means. That is Jesus's, I don't want to say reduction, expansion of this beautiful theological understanding that yes, this is all about loving God with all of our hearts and loving our neighbors as ourselves. And that simply means when you see somebody who's fallen, who's been beaten up, when you see somebody who's had that nasty fall, you are willing to do what you can to pick them up, to put them on your donkey, to care for their wounds. That is precisely how we create this kingdom of heaven, this place where God's will is done on earth, this place where I can't change what may be happening on the other side of the planet, but on this road, on this path where that person is bleeding and hurting, I can stop. I can help. I can do something here. I'm so grateful for these stories that we see in Scripture of God working through whoever will be used. Amos, the shepherd from Tekoa, a Samaritan, somebody who may not understand it. It's of course what we see Jesus, God's self doing for us. It's what we get the chance to do for one another. May you this week be filled with that same spirit. That spirit of courage, of connectedness, of recognition of yourself in the other, knowing that whoever you may find beat up, bleeding, hurting, you can do something to help. This is one of the reasons we come together and pray for each other and share what is going on, because we are family and we are connected. And when we lift one another up in prayer, it ends up moving us towards action as well.